Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Friday, November 28th, 2014. Just seconds after 17 UTC as I start this. It's just me. So right before the time that we were normally scheduled to record, I sent a text to Yvonne saying, "Hey, I know you're out traveling doing family Thanksgiving things. Just wanted to make sure we're still on." And he replies and basically says, "No, we're not." And so that was too late for me to arrange any other co-hosts. And of course, it's the middle of the holiday season too, so it's hard to get people, I would imagine, because everybody's busy doing their holiday stuff. Anyway, it is Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving, as I talk to you, and I have the day off from work. I took the day off. You know, in past, I've very often not taken off, you know, the day between Thanksgiving and the weekend, or the week between Christmas and New Year's, because, you know, I figured it's a fairly slow time at work. You can get some stuff done. You can, whatever. It's sort of a semi-relaxing time, even though you're at work. But this year, I think, no, I'm taking those days. You know, I need the time at home. I need to, I don't know. Anyway, and those are, you know, sometimes you get some stuff done. Sometimes you're just sitting there like, okay, I'm here, but there's nothing much to do because it's slow. So anyway, I'm here and it's time to do a show. I've got a number of topics lined up. Oh, yeah, I guess hope everybody had a good holiday. We had a good one here. You know, just the little family, and my mom came over, and we had the usual sort of Thanksgiving food and hung out a little bit, you know, nothing special. Hope everybody else's was good too. Yeah. See, I had to make sure to get that out. Anyway, there are a bunch of things potentially on my list here. Of course, there's the Ferguson stuff and, police violence in general and things like that. And, you know, that's probably going to be the big topic of the day, in terms of anything real. Miscellaneous other little stuff, but that's going to be the big one. So, I'll probably start with a miscellany and then move on to that and wrap up the show. I will refrain from saying it will be short, because I always say, well, I've stopped the last few times because, you know, it's just not true. I always expect that if it's just me talking, I'll blah, 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 and I'll be done. And hey, it was only 15 minutes or something. But no, it never happens that way. I always go just as long as our regular shows. So in any case, it has been, you know, a week with a bunch of stuff going on. At first, the stuff with just me, obviously I mentioned Thanksgiving. Yeah, it was good, you know, whatever. Now we're in a nice long weekend following that. I also had this thing going on, with my iMac. For those of you who followed me on Twitter, my machine died last weekend. I, you know, came in the morning, sat down. I'd gotten up before my son had, and I was like, oh, good. Maybe I'll get an hour or so in at my computer before he wakes up. And it wouldn't turn on. And specifically, it took me a while to figure out it was off, because I never actually turn off the computer. And I figured it was asleep or whatever. I hit a button, nothing happens. I hit a button, nothing happens. You know, I jiggle the mouse, nothing happens. And turns out it was just, you know, nothing. It wasn't on. It wasn't turning on. Nothing you did would turn it on. I took it to the Apple Store, and as it turns out, it was just the power supply. They replaced the power supply, which, including labor, was just over $100, and I'm good to go exactly how I was. Now, you know, this did have me entertaining for a while, a thought of, you know, okay, it's finally time to replace the iMac. It is 5 years old. You know, don't get me wrong, a new iMac sounds awesome, especially those new Retina 5K ones. You know, they look beautiful. It would be awesome. It would be much faster than the one I have. And, you know, I you know, get frustrated by the speed of this thing on a regular basis. But, you know, not in the budget, really. If we'd had to do it, if my computer was absolutely dead, would we have done something? I'm sure we would have done something. Would I have gotten the absolute top of the line like I would like to do? Maybe not. I might have compromised. But, you know, still better not to do it right now if we don't have to, you know, and as I mentioned a few weeks ago on the show, at least in, you know, it's still not, well, it's starting to be true of the phones and tablets as well, but, you know, it used to be that, after a certain number of years, it's just, you had to switch, you know, because if you were doing, if you were keeping your operating system up to date and you were running the newest and latest software of various things, if you were doing anything other than just saying, I'm going to continue doing exactly what I did on the day that I bought the computer in the way I did it, you would feel the pain after a few years. You know, and you'd feel like you had to upgrade. And, you know, look, I'm feeling a little bit of pain, but it's not, like, bad. I mean, basically, all the things I do with my computer, I can still do with my computer. And so it really is switching to the mode of, you know, you replace it when you have to, when it breaks, and when it breaks in an unfixable way. And, you know, it's not there yet. And I got to believe that that's, you know, it's a product of having a sort of a mature life cycle for these things, and higher quality, and also a little bit since there's been a new sort of new feature or function or whatever that really required the absolutely most up-to-date hardware to run it. And we haven't had that in a couple years. I mean, unless you're a gamer and you're pushing the limits of that kind of stuff, but I'm not. And so here we go. Anyway, I'm glad my computer is fixed, although it was fun for a couple days to sort of fantasize about the new machine. But it was just a power supply. So far. And everything else is just how it was before or better, which, you know, great. Here, another thing. You know, when we had Bruce on the show a couple weeks ago, he mentioned I never did movie reviews and such. So he gave me a review of Interstellar. I still haven't seen Interstellar, but I did see a movie. So I'm going to give a movie review. And as a bonus, I'm going to give a couple book reviews, because I finished one actual book and I finished an Audible book in the last Audible's branded audiobook, whatever, and I finished a couple of those this week, so I'll do that. So real quick, we saw Big Hero 6. The whole family saw it. It was a cute little superhero movie. The little, I forget the stupid thing's name, but the little blobby robot guy was really cute. Exactly what you expect for sort of light family Disney fare with a superhero-ish theme. Without giving any real spoilers, it has the common Disney trope of, like, you know, family members dying right at the beginning in order to or being dead or whatever in order to give the main characters sort of their impetus to, like, you grow up and find their destiny or whatever. I mean, literally, come on. Disney does this in practically every movie. Like, you know, Bambi, The Lion King, practically every Disney movie you can think of. Like, you know, how do you start? You kill the parents. I mean, Frozen last year, but whatever. You know, you'd think occasionally they could do something different. But anyway, a lot of fun. I would recommend it as a family movie to anybody who's got kids of the appropriate age. I mean, it's not bad for adults either. You know, it's the typical of these family movies where they try to make it good for everybody. And so, should, you know, yes, Worth it. It was fun. It was good. My daughter liked it. My son, who's five, of course, paid attention the entire time. There was only one moment where it started to get a little slow, and he looked over at me for like, 5-10 seconds, like, hey, what's going on here? And then it sped up right at the right time, because otherwise he was going to start doing something, but he didn't. He paid attention the entire time. Of course, he denies he likes it. You know, because of course he could never admit right up front that he likes something, but he did. He paid, you know, you can tell by the way he was focused. So that's my quick movie review. Book reviews. I alternate for physical books, which at this point means as much as possible, about 75% of the time is Kindle books. I alternate fiction and nonfiction. And then on the nonfiction side, I alternate between nonfiction I read because I'm just interested in it, and nonfiction that in some conceivable way, sometimes it's a little bit of a stretch, sometimes it's more direct, it's related to what I do for a living. And so this one was, this time I finished a nonfiction book that is somewhat related to what I do for a living, but not really, kind of. But it was, in this case, it's Headfirst Java. And look, I am not a software developer. I don't do that kind of stuff. However, I deal with them all the time. And so it's good to have context and a little bit more of understanding of, you know, in order to have conversations with people who do that stuff. And I've read some Java books before, but I saw this one was actually one that my wife used in a class when she was back at school last year. And I was like, oh, that looks kind of interesting. I'll pick that one up. And so I will say about this one. So this is basically an introduction to the Java programming language. The one thing that it has going for it, and I gather this whole series does, I hadn't read one in this series before, is it's in a very conversational tone. Basically it's a lot friendlier than other, technical books that I've read that are, you know, trying to teach a language or whatever. There was a lot less of the, you know, here's the statement, here's its format, here's how you use it, and here's some, you know, very dry discussion of it. No, they try to sort of spice it up and make things very, very sort of light and humorous and conversational. And I found that very nice, because usually with this kind of book, honestly, I dread them, because I will read them, I will go through them, but I find myself with very little desire to actually read it, and I have to force myself to push my way through it. For the most part, I didn't find that to be the case. I sort of slowed down a bit in the middle, but it was nice to have this approach. Let me read this almost in the same way that I would read other interesting nonfiction books, because it did have a sort of narrative and flow, and it wasn't super super dry and technical, and that was fun. And so I think it was helpful in learning and going through things. I think most of this I'd actually seen before in other books I'd read, but you know, it was a nice refresher. Also, I should say, to get the most value out of books like this, you actually have to, you know, when they have examples and exercises and things to try and things like, you should actually do those things and try those things and all of that sort of thing. And I typically do not, and I did not this time, because I'm not reading it to actually get to the point where I can sit down at a computer and do something with this. If I really wanted to do that, I would, you know, grab a book like this plus a couple reference books and actually try to do something. And I'm sure I could, but don't really want to. My purpose is more having background reference knowledge about what's possible and what's not and how things work. And, you know, I am not trying to get to the point where I can be an expert myself. So I generally just, you know, read through these from start to finish to try to absorb the general gist of a bunch of things without actually trying to build my own expertise. And anyway, it was good. I liked it. I should say I liked it in comparison to other books of this genre. I still wouldn't, you know, recommend just picking it up for fun unless you had like a reason to. And finally, the one that I'm now also doing audiobooks because I spend a significant amount of time commuting back and forth to work, and I listen to podcasts, I sometimes listen to music, I sometimes listen to various talk radio stations, a variety of other things. I've got like a list of seven or something that I switch between. But I recently added to that mix, you know, within this year, so it's been a number of months, audiobooks. And that's actually been quite useful, I think. It's currently my second priority behind podcasts when I drive in the car, but I may well bump it to first at some point because I am enjoying it. And for these, I'm alternating fiction and nonfiction, but without the ones that are potentially work-related. Just my own fiction, my own nonfiction. Well, not my own like I wrote it, but you know, my own that there are things I'm interested in. Yeah, for fun, basically. And so I just finished My Beloved World, which is a memoir of Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor. Is a fairly short, but nice. I liked it. This was my first biography I'd listened to. I definitely read some biography here and there, but I have not done one of a Supreme Court justice before or any judge before. I've read about presidents and scientists and other things, but this was my first Supreme Court justice, so it was interesting. Reading the story of, you know, her life, it basically goes through. Actually, before the beginning, it tells a little bit about her parents and grandparents, through to her first nomination to the federal bench. It does not talk anything about her tenure on the Supreme Court. That might be something for after retirement sometime. But anyway, again, interesting. This is. One of the stories of someone who came from an underprivileged background and went through a lot to get to where she is. But primarily, you can tell that she was driven from the very beginning to excel in everything she was doing and follow her interests and... you know, truly extraordinary. You know, with these kinds of things, for the, there are certainly people who get to important positions in other ways, but this is clearly someone who did it by always being, you know, at the very top of whatever she was involved in, from high school to undergraduate to graduate school to when she was working. As a prosecutor to when she was working in private practice, all of these cases, she was clearly both due to sort of native skill and to just drive right at the top, more than the top 1%, top half of a percent, top tenth of a percent, clearly standing out above others in her field. Of course, I'm reading this from her memoir, so that might be tilted somewhat, but it seems like there are quite a few distinct things that could be pointed to objectively to make that point. A very interesting person, very interesting family, interesting background. So it was also fun to read. This was one that came as sometime... a year or two ago, I forget, I have it written down somewhere, but my mom made a Facebook post that she had read this and it was interesting. So I added it to my list and it came up. For those of you who don't know, my list is really long and huge. And basically whenever I have to whenever I'm ready to read a new book, I essentially pick at random from the list of books that I've previously put down as interesting. And so I'm not, hey, this is the thing I really, really want to read next. Instead, it's more, okay, I'm ready to read another book. Let's look at the list of all of the things that over the last few years I've added and said, hey, I might want to read that sometime, and pick one. And like I said, I alternate fiction, nonfiction. I've also recently added, because I got frustrated that with my method, if there were series of books, I would never get the next one in the series because I just had too many things on my list. So I also now have a thing where I separate out continuing series versus brand new things and give a 50-50 shot of continuing a series rather than starting something new. And by series, I consider not just real series, but also sometimes where I'm trying to read through the works of an author. So it's not necessarily, you know, item 1, 2, and 3 in a trilogy, but it may be this author has written 10 books. Let's read all of them. Anyway, enough of that. Those are my reviews for today. A little different. Haven't done that before. We'll be back. I'm going to take another. I'm going to take a break, and we'll be back, and we'll some of this other stuff. Back after this. Back. And just as a note that, you know, most of you don't care. Nobody. Oh, I hear noises. I was going to say, usually when I do these by myself, I record a segment, then listen to a segment and put it together, then record another segment, put it together. But since I'm doing this in the morning before everybody wakes, especially my son, I was just going to record. Of course, I hear noises out there. So I don't know if somebody's waking up. Another thing to mention, since I was talking movies, this morning the trailer for the new Star Wars came out. I just watched it. It's a minute long, minute and a half, whatever. Not much there, but exciting. You know, of course, the prequels were disappointing to absolutely everybody in the universe except people, you know, under 7 maybe. And hopefully these new ones won't be. We'll see. It comes out more than a year away, so they're going to spend the next year teasing us, but they have finished photography and everything on it. So one of the things that is my goal, of course, is to my son is 5. He knows who Darth Vader is, but he has not yet seen the movies. So I'm going to, at some point in the next year, we will watch the existing movies, and yeah, probably all 6, but in the order they were produced, not in the chronological order, because the first 3 are kind of not great. But we gotta, you know, get them indoctrinated in Star Wars stuff before the new movie comes out. And 5 is old enough, right, for Star Wars? Yeah, it is. Anyway. Non-Ferguson things to talk about real quick in the news. We talked about the immigration stuff last week, and we recorded the day before Obama made his announcement. So just real quick, wanted to discuss it based on the actual announcement. It was pretty much as expected. Protections for the parents of Dreamers, a few other classes, of people, added up to a few million people who will be affected by it. A lot of groups still are not. And so I saw a lot of interviews of people saying they were glad they were covered, but their friends aren't or whatever. And the predicted reactions were, you know, exactly as one would expect and very, very much down partisan lines, with Democrats saying basically this is fully within the power of the president and it really needed to be done. And Congress didn't act, the president is, and there you go. Whereas Republicans very much saying this is going well and above the proper powers of the president, and this is a realm that should be decided by Congress, not the president, and he's exceeding his authority, and we need to do something, although there's no consensus on what to do. We mentioned last week, you've got impeachment, you've got various tricks you can do with the budget to try to force him, you've got shutdowns. Another that has been mentioned is you could actually do a congressional censure that... is a lot easier to get through than an impeachment, but of course also has no practical ramifications to it. It's just sort of a slap on the wrist. That's pretty much where it is. And, honestly, it started once Ferguson happened, it sort of fell out of the news, and I don't know if it'll come back and how much. I'm sure we'll hear about it again as we go forward. But fundamentally, the Republicans are in somewhat of a sticky point on this one politically, because process questions don't typically tend to get the public's attention quite as much. Because frankly, like if you talk to a lot of people, they assume the president can make all these decisions anyway, you know, and they're looking at what's the actual thing that's happening, and do we agree with it or do we not? And on this, the polls seem to say that for the most part, although there is a, you know, as with most things, there's a strong division and strong feelings on both sides, the majority seems to be fine with giving amnesty to certain classes of people and giving paths to citizenship and this and that, and and in this case, we're talking about some fairly photogenic situations where if you actually were deporting people, you were breaking up families, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the process stuff is a little bit more esoteric, and people who pay attention to it care. But even there, there's all kinds of precedents you can look at that, you know, at various scales or another, all sorts of previous presidents have done similar things. This is by far the biggest. But these kinds of actions have been taken by executive order before. Obama has actually done fewer executive orders than most of his predecessors. So there's precedent here. Now, I'm one who doesn't like executive action in general. I think it's the wrong way to get things done. I think Congress should do these things. But at the same time, I recognize that, you know, Congress may have the goal of, you know, specifically the Republican strategy in Congress has been, we don't really believe in government doing a lot of things. So if we're obstructionist and keep laws from being passed, keep this from happening, then it won't happen. Government will end up doing less, and will implicitly get our goals without having to sort of articulate sort of the Republican version of how to deal with the immigration situation. Instead, you know, don't pass anything, keep the status quo, and go about that way. But as I'm losing my train of thought looking at a Star Wars lightsaber, this approach almost guarantees you that the executive will work to expand their power, because the executive is going to say, I want to do things. And you know, you could see this happening in mirror image the other way around. But specifically now, we have a Democratic president who has been frustrated for years now because he can't get done the things that he believes needs to get done. And he tried multiple times. I mean, his whole reason, the whole central theme of his campaign in 2008, regardless of what liberals misinterpreted and hoped it to be, was not being a liberal crusader. It was trying to figure out how to work with Republicans to come through with centrist solutions that would make everybody happy. And that was what he really, really wanted to do. And that failed utterly because the Republicans weren't going to play ball. And now he's at the point where he's in the last 2 years of his term. There's no more elections in front of him. There's no more elections even for his party that he's going to be the central figure on. So his hands are somewhat freed. And so he can start doing things by executive action, and he'll have his team of lawyers look at it and say, of course you can do this. It's legal. And frankly, there's not much that folks can do about it. Because as we've talked about, the only real recourse, if Congress really felt strongly about it, would be impeachment, but there's not the support there for a conviction. So that's not going to happen. I mean, they can go, maybe they'll go through the political show, if they, but I think the, at least the Republican leadership realizes that's a losing game too. And the courts are very likely to, if it goes to the courts, say, you know, this is a political question, leave us out of it. Yeah, there's a chance they might not, but that's typically what they've done in these kinds of situations in the past. And so, of course, it'll stand, at least through the 2 years. Now, one of the things with executive orders and what is made, even with the previous executive order that Obama did on the DREAM Act, is that a lot of people aren't taking advantage of it. Why? Because they realize that as an executive order, any subsequent president can reverse it on a whim. So now the politics of that are difficult. So even if you know, a Republican won in 2016, it might be difficult for them to just do a complete reversal and say, nope, we're deporting those people after all, as soon as he got in. Now, they could. They could. And so a lot of people who are eligible for these things have not taken advantage of them for that reason. But the longer it's in place, the harder it is to do that action, not physically, but politically, because, you run the risk of doing something very unpopular. But of course, there you can still do the very unpopular thing. Anyway, I think this is one of those issues that's going to probably be one of these things where we've already seen the biggest flash of outrage for this, and we're going to continue hearing about it at a low level, along with a list of other, you know, things that people are mad at Obama for. But you're not going to see sort of major action centered on this, I don't think. Because it's a hard game for the Republicans to win. So they'll just have it on their list. They'll use it as something at times to rally the base. But I don't think it's going to be a major theme coming into 2016. And the actual action will go forward. And I expect to see more of these from Obama on various issues where he's going to do as much as he can through executive action. And that's going to be a more expansive view of that than it has been in the past. That'll continue through the rest of the term. And of course, it's a ratchet thing with presidential power. Once one president claims it, all future presidents will claim it as well. You never, or almost never, I should say, see a reversal where you see a president say, you know, I know all sorts of previous presidents have done that, but I believe they were wrong and I don't have the authority to do this, so I will never do that. That's incredibly rare. And even if one president says it, there's nothing to stop the next president from saying, well, he was wrong. He does have the power, and I'm going to take it. Anyway, fun, I guess. Okay, I'm going to take another break. We'll be back. I have a couple other miscellaneous issues, and then the last segment will be on Ferguson. Back after this. Okay, we're back. And I hear more noises outside this room, so I don't know how long I have until I'm interrupted. but the two other things I wanted to mention before we get to Ferguson are Iran and Bill Cosby. So let's start with Iran. They extended the deadline for their talks another 6 months or so. But everyone says some progress has been made, blah, blah, blah. If we extend this past past January, of course, though, it's going to be harder to get through anything that's agreed in the Senate if it does come out in sort of treaty form, which, of course, like we were just talking about, the president can do various things by executive action, too. But they can, of course, be reversed by the next president if the next president doesn't agree. The thing that I find most interesting about all of this Iran stuff in general, first of all, of course, both sides seem to have primary parties who want a deal with significant domestic resistance that doesn't want a deal. And that's the real dynamic here. It's not a dynamic over what kind of deal should we have. The fundamental dynamic seems to be, significant groups of people who think a deal in and of itself is fundamentally a bad thing to have. In that any sort of concession that says, Iran is allowed to have, some sort of nuclear program, is fundamentally in and of itself bad. And honestly, I have a hard time relating to that position. I realize that because, and part of it fundamentally ties to, do you believe that any deal will actually stick? I mean, a lot of people say, well, the reason any deal is bad is because we don't believe them. We fundamentally don't believe them, the Iranians. I'm talking from the American perspective now. And that no matter what they agree to, they'll just continue doing what they want to do. They'll just make it harder to see. And of course, some of these statements are like, and they've been cheating already in the current deal. And whereas it seems like the evidence from, independent inspectors and stuff like that seems to be that Iran actually is keeping up their end of the deal. It seems clear that the Iranian leadership wants a deal, again, with a significant, domestic pressure in the other direction, but I know I'm repeating myself to other times we've talked about Iran, but I fundamentally can't get past the hypocrisy of saying, it's okay for some countries to have this, but not you. And we'll trust this country and this country and this country and this country with this. But you guys, no, you can't have this. You're not allowed. And I recognize that, the government of Iran is one that we have disagreed on with any number of things at various points in the past. You've even been able to construe them as quote unquote enemies. If you look at this from an Israeli perspective instead of an American one, maybe more so. But, that's an entirely different ballgame. I think they shouldn't be tied that closely. But even there, I think what we've actually seen in the past. Back up a little bit, too. The Iranian religious leadership, which is really in charge, has said time and time and time and time again that they believe nuclear weapons are against their religion, and it would, nobody should follow them. And I recognize that we don't believe that they mean it. because they have at various times done preparatory steps that seem like they're moving in that direction. But fundamentally here, I think this is an area where, A, I think we benefit from, you know, Ronald Reagan's old approach of trust but verify, in that give them benefit of the doubt. Assume they're actually telling the truth about what they want. Start from that perspective. Recognize that, okay, there's a possibility they're lying, and put in place enough protections to detect and figure out what's going on there. Excuse me. But you have to start from the perspective of looking from your adversary's point of view, trying to understand them, trying to understand where they're coming from. And of course, I used the word adversary there. It doesn't have to be an adversarial thing. It's just that's where we historically are at this point. And put in those protections. But if you start from the perspective of assuming absolutely that everything the other side says is always a lie, then of course you won't get anywhere. But of course, as again, like, the fundamental divide is between people who actually believe a deal would be a good thing and people who think that a deal is fundamentally bad, even if they were telling the truth. We still don't want the deal. We don't believe they're telling the truth, but we still don't want the deal. And you see that pressure exerting itself here. So you got to wonder how this plays out. Do you actually manage to get to a deal over the next 6 months, or even assume further extensions through the end of the Obama presidency? Or is this just buying time, where the longer we maintain sort of the status quo of the interim deal, the better off the parties and build more confidence, et cetera? But I'm fundamentally in the camp that the ultimate goal here should be normalization of relationships, of relations. And I know nobody's even talking about that quite per se yet, but that's got to be the long-term goal, is bring Iran back into the friendly family of nations and see what happens. And, you know, yes, they can be a regional power. It makes sense that they should be a regional power. This whole sort of dynamic where, I guess, on both sides, Iran was made out as an enemy, and in Iran, the U.S. was made out as an enemy, it's like so counterproductive. Because it's, of course, self-fulfilling. And I've actually said before, you know, screw it, even like the can they get nuclear weapons? You know, they say they don't want to. It's probably a bad thing for anybody to have nuclear weapons that doesn't have them already. Okay, I'll agree with all that kind of stuff. However, we've actually seen in practice in various points in, you know, and India, Pakistan is the clearest example. But you could argue even U.S. Soviet Union is an example, that the presence of the nuclear weapons actually did lead to reductions in hostilities eventually, because people were afraid to actually take action because they knew how destructive it would be. I think, you know, there's a containment solution here. The notion of trying to keep the genie in the bottle, I think, is a losing game. I mean, we can try to do it as, you know, push things off as long as possible, but fundamentally, the engineering knowledge is out there. Getting the materials is the hardest part. You know, eventually we'll get to the point where anybody can make a nuclear bomb in their backyard if they feel like it, and then we're in real trouble. But because you'll always get the wackos who would set them off, just like we have the wackos who would go into the movie theaters with their guns. But we're not there yet. But anyway, yeah, this is one of those rambling things. I apologize. I I'm all for the negotiations. I think they should continue. I hope for a good result. I think we're very likely to just continue kicking the can down the road a little bit. And if we do get a deal, both sides are going to have problems in the implementation of those in terms of how to make it happen and make it stick. And I think we'll get one of those scenarios where, you know, it may not even, you know, it's going to be done exclusively by the executive saying, yeah, this is what we're going to do right now, which of course means it doesn't necessarily have force of treaty, but that may be the best that can be done. We'll see. And if there is any deal, of course, you'll hear Israel and the neocons screaming bloody murder about it, no matter what the deal is. No matter how many protections are in place, it's going to be not liked by that side of things. But my take is, and, you know, reverse it if you can, if you take power again. And of course, yeah, whatever. Congress can try to do more stuff with the sanctions to thwart whatever the president does. But of course, we got veto power. So you've got that stalemate everywhere. And the dynamic that Congress is going to be running into is that any place where the president can do things by executive action, they can't do anything about it. And meanwhile, they also can't achieve anything positive that they want because the president can veto that as well. The only things that would possibly be able to go through are things where you truly can get bipartisan support, but the Republicans have their own political reasons for not wanting that to happen. So those won't happen either. Another break, then Cosby, then another break, then Ferguson. Wow. Anyway, back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula? I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then, let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, back again. Cosby. You know, I don't have a huge amount to say with this other than what the fuck? Really? I mean, obviously nothing's been, you know, put in a court of law, blah, 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 no actual charges, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's not the standard here. There, the number of accusations from so many different people, you'd have to really suspend belief considerably to come to the conclusion that all of these women were making this stuff up. It seems almost certain, you know, to the point of it being ridiculous to think otherwise, that yes, indeed, Bill Cosby was a significant sexual predator and a complete and total scumbag. The common theme in all of these accusations, was not just him using his position and fame, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to, you know, influence, women into sleeping with him, which of course is a, you know, common theme among, you know, high power alpha males everywhere, probably unfortunate, but true. Going beyond sort of just using his fame to get women. No, it's drugging people, you know, taking advantage of them while they were not at all capable of consenting, and sometimes from the sound of it, they might not even have been fully conscious. And then And then paying them off in various ways to shut up and be quiet and go away. And it seems like it's been a repeated pattern. And not only that, you know, these accusations aren't brand new. They've just come up again this time. But each other time, they've always sort of been swept under the rug in one way or another. He had a major settlement where he paid off a bunch of these women. Apparently, he was paying off women in other ways before that, outside of the legal system. Various biographers have chosen not to mention this when they did their biographies of him. All sorts of articles about this. And basically, you know, there was a guy who came out this week who was worked at NBC while he was on The Cosby Show and apparently acted as a quote-unquote fixer, acting as an intermediary to payoffs for these women or to acquire women and bring them back to his room and blah, 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 all this stuff. And so there were tons and tons of people who knew this was going on and just remained silent. Said, well, you know, it's Bill Cosby. It's Cliff Huxtable. And, of course, now, you know, effectively, I don't think he's going to bounce back from this and suddenly be have a continued super popular career. You know, several projects he had ongoing were canceled. He has done a couple of shows where he got standing ovations, et cetera, after one of them in Melbourne, Florida, where I used to live, I believe. But he's basically done at this point. But the question is why he wasn't done decades ago. And this is just another example where, you know, the viewpoint seems to have generally been, oh, well, that's just how it works. That's how it goes. That's what's going on. And that's not okay. It's not okay now, and it wasn't okay then. And, you know, the question becomes, how do you change people's viewpoints and mindsets so that you don't have people turning the other way when this kind of thing happens? Or assuming that, an assumption that was correct, that if you've got a super powerful person misbehaving, that there's not much you can do about it, because even if you say something, nobody's going to believe you or nobody's going to pay attention. And I don't know the answers to that question, but I think, you know, we are seeing a lot more talk and prevalence of discussions of these kinds of things, which is a first step. You know, you heard about it with... there have been a few high profile rape cases lately. There's been the one that involved that football team somewhere in Pennsylvania that, you know, they got away scot free, but there was a lot of talk and outrage and blah blah blah. And whereas in the past it would have just been completely invisible, and so you've got a slow movement, I think, but you do have movement. That basically, you know, needs to hold people to a higher standard than we've held them before, and also pay attention to these things. I mean, the insidious bit is just boys will be boys. That happens. No, that's not okay. You know? And it tinged with, of course, the also, you know, people in positions of power, whether it be like the captain of the football team, or whether it be Bill Cosby, or whether it be the president of the United States, you know, we have to build up the mechanisms whereby we sort of equalize the playing field so that if there is a wrongdoing, the fact that you are important, powerful, rich doesn't automatically mean that you get away with whatever you were getting away with. And this certainly that applies to, you know, rape and sexual abuse allegations, but it also applies to, the bankers bringing down the financial system in 2009, and completely and totally getting away with it. Not that that was their intention, but that was the result of their negligent actions. Anyway, I don't know the answer, but I just look at all of these reports and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. First of all, that he would do this kind of stuff. I mean, we've talked about this with various politicians who've gotten in trouble for, affairs or, sexting pictures of themselves to people, whatever. It's like, what is the malfunction that causes someone who is nominally on top of the world, going in great directions with their career, to engage in incredibly self-destructive behavior in many of these cases also destructive of other people, but where it's like, well, duh, eventually you're going to get caught. Eventually this is going to cause a problem for you. Is it so hard to do something else? I mean, like in the Bill Cosby situation, really? He was going out and drugging women in order to have sex with them? He was the star of a number one show. He had tons of money. He had tons of access. He didn't have to do that just to get some sex. I'm sure of it. But yet the method he chose was drugging people. And taking advantage of various people in various other ways? Really? Come on now. It's ridiculous. So many of these cases, it's just, what the hell were they thinking? And of course the answer is, A, many times they weren't thinking at all. B, they felt like they're on top of the world, invincible, and could get away with whatever the hell they want, and the rules don't apply to them. And that's fundamentally the problem. The rules have to apply. Okay, enough Cosby. Taking another break, and we'll finally talk about Ferguson for a little while. We've already gone like an hour, so I don't know how long I'll talk about Ferguson, but we'll talk about Ferguson. Back after this.
Information.
As I was starting the segment, I see Alex coming in the room. Hello, Alex. I'm recording my podcast right now. Did you have a good sleep?
Happy birthday to kill no one. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to no one. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to no one. Happy birthday to you.
Very nice. Okay, well, I guess I'm going to take another quick break, and I'll talk about Ferguson once I have the freedom to do so again. So I know it's only been a minute, but here, have another exciting break. Back after this. Okay, several hours have passed, and it's finally time for me to talk about Ferguson. So, there are a few different parts of this, and I want to separate them. They tend to get all mushed up together into one big blob of anger and confusion and upset. So first of all, let's start with what actually happened that day. And we've got, since they released all of the stuff that was put in front of the grand jury, we've got more information about this than we had before. But yet, it's still full of all kinds of contradictory eyewitness testimony, physical evidence that could be interpreted multiple ways, the whole mismatch. Now, what seems most likely here? First of all, if you look at the testimony of the sort of two people who had sort of the best view of what was going on, the officer and Mike Brown's friend, you'll see it's like looking at, you could tell there's like a consistent story behind it, but all of the details are shifted in one direction or another. And of course, they both seem to be shifted entirely in the direction that's self-serving for the person talking. And is one of them completely true? I would highly doubt that. I think both of their testimonies are probably suspect, and the truth is somewhere probably in between. You can see a completely reasonable narrative that is somewhere in between, where the police officer does initially come off as hostile and provocative, and then the kids react in a hostile way, and it just escalates and escalates. I mean, because in the end, you did have the situation where one way or another, they were struggling inside the police car. And of course, again, you can read this in a variety of extremes. And then he was running away. And then he was shot. And were his hands up? Were his hands not up? You know, was he running at the officer aggressively? Or was he trying to surrender? And unfortunately, it's an absolutely plausible scenario to say that he did have his hands up and was trying to surrender, but the police officer, in the state of mind that he was, interpreted that as him coming at him aggressively. They could both be right on that critical point. And could that impression of what he was doing be tinged with racial bias? Absolutely. Absolutely it could be. In fact, it's very plausible. I was listening to some podcasts within the last few days on someone who, it was off C-SPAN, actually, I think. Or was it off C-SPAN? Anyway, doesn't matter. It was somebody who had done a bunch of psychological studies on racial bias, basically. And they'd found a number of things. First of all, there's a lot of subconscious racial bias that people aren't directly aware of. And they're counterintuitive things as well. Like, the people who are most worried about appearing to be racially biased actually tend to act in ways that are more racially biased than people who aren't self-conscious about it, because they get all trapped into thinking, oh, what are people going to think about how I do this? And the rational facilities leave them to some degree. Interesting stuff. Anyway, it's completely plausible that on that particular critical moment, they are both accurately representing how they viewed the situation. Now, as Yvonne and I said when we first talked about this way, way, way back when, I guess it wasn't that long ago now, a couple months, everybody in this situation seems to have mishandled it. The Brown and what was his name? Johnson? I forget. They clearly, acted... I shouldn't say clearly because everything's somewhat in doubt, but it seems likely that they acted defiantly when confronted by the police officer, whereas, saying yes, sir, okay, sir, and getting off the sidewalk probably would have avoided a lot of this. However, it also seems fairly clear that the officer was probably overly aggressive for the situation and overreacted a number of situations, a number of points in the process. And one thing you have to say here is, while you can say, okay, well, they both acted improperly, they both acted more aggressively than they should have, and that's probably what happened. I mean, come on. But only one person in this situation was had the duty to protect public safety here above and all everything else. It's the police officer's responsibility to make sure that they are responding appropriately to the situation at hand. I would hope that part of the duty was to do everything possible to de-escalate a situation. And I know that's not actually necessarily how training goes everywhere in the country, but that should be an important part. You should always be looking at how can we de-escalate? How can we get out of this without, causing whatever? And I think there's a lot in law and policies around police officers that don't necessarily go in that direction. Like, you can fire at somebody fleeing a felony. I think that's wrong right off the bat. Unless you feel there's an imminent danger to someone else, you should let them go. Try to catch them later. Better to let just because they just committed a felony, which, by the way, was not the case in this situation, probably, doesn't mean it should be okay to kill them. The death penalty applies only to a small handful of crimes, and it's, I would argue that it's not justified even then, but even assuming it is, it's only a small handful of crimes and only after proper due process. So, anyway, moving on from what actually happened that day. Then we've got these grand jury proceedings. which a number of sites have documented all of the ways these were unusual compared to other grand jury situations. How there were misleading instructions to the juror about standard of evidence. And how a lot of stuff that usually doesn't happen till trial was happening in the grand jury. All kinds of irregularities here. Now, you could actually argue that the perfunctory nature of most grand juries is actually what's improper, and that more of this stuff should be happening on all grand jury investigations, but separate argument. Here's the thing on the grand jury decision. It may have been right. There may have been a great injustice done here, but it may have been the right thing to do to not charge. Now, it may well be that the prosecutor could have made this decision up front rather than going through the facade, the whole process of the grand jury. But look, here's the fundamental. Let's say that first of all, there are two standards of evidence. As I understand this, and I'm not a lawyer, Don't yell at me, any lawyers who are listening. One is for the grand jury. It's basically just probable cause. That you think there might have been a crime. And then at the trial, if there is one, it's, of course, beyond a shadow of a doubt, et cetera, beyond a reasonable doubt, sorry. Very different standard. So you could very well say what absolutely positively should have happened here is that there is enough here for an indictment. Because there's probable cause. Something weird happened, or something weird might have happened. There's all sorts of contradictory evidence. Some of it points towards the officer doing something that was illegal. Some of it points that he did exactly what he was supposed to do. But what's going to happen then? If it does go to trial, now you're going to have... Oh, and one of the arguments for it going to trial is you'll have the whole adversarial system. You'd have people, making the strongest possible case in both directions. But, and maybe there would be more that would come out or be discovered in that process. I grant you that. However, just based on what we've seen so far in the evidence that was released, it seems clear there would be reasonable doubt. Like, you could determine that almost certainly the officer did things wrong. Almost certainly he was more aggressive than he should have been. Almost certainly he should have refrained from at least some of those shots. Even if you could say some of the shots were justified, he didn't have to, do the last few that actually resulted in a death. You could say all that, but still... Because of all of the conflicting testimony, all of the conflicting evidence, the ability of someone to come up with a plausible story that looks different, you're going to end up with reasonable doubt. And so if you had an indictment here, you would almost certainly... not get a conviction at the end of the day in the trial. So what exactly is the purpose of doing those intermediary steps? And this is where we get into prosecutorial discretion. And, we mentioned this in the immigration context a while ago, just because we don't have the physical ability to deport everybody who is technically eligible for deportation, so prosecutors have to use their discretion on which ones to go after and which ones not to. The same thing is true of any prosecution. And one of the things that's common is, of course, if you don't think you can get a conviction, you don't necessarily even indict in the first place. And that seems like the situation you would end up in here. And it seems like the whole process of going through the grand jury is basically just the prosecutor covering his ass. and making sure that he can say, well, it was their decision, not mine. And of course, then conducting it in such a way that it didn't end up going in the direction he didn't want it to go anyway. So if I was on that grand jury, would I have voted to indict? I don't know. I think purely on the basis of if my job is to determine is there probable cause, the answer is yes. I probably would have been voted to indict, but I don't think it would have ended up with a conviction and trial if it went that way. So what's really going on here? I mean, there's still some very real things here. Some of it's the problems with the law itself. That gives police officers way, way, way too much discretion in the use of violence in general and the use of deadly force specifically. I should mention, yeah, there's so many other ways in which the process was tainted. When we talked about this at first and when I tweeted more recently, there's almost no step in the process that the authorities seem to have not screwed up here. And of course, screwing them up comes to their own benefit. I mean, there's evidence that was not collected properly. There was testimony that was not collected until way later than it should have been. There were, for God's sake, there were no autopsy photos taken because the camera ran out of batteries? You've got to be kidding me. Go get some fucking batteries. Every step of the way, there has been what looks like, at best, you color it as massive incompetence in how to handle this investigation. And at worst, which honestly I feel is probably closer to the truth, it's just people intentionally doing things badly in order to fuzzy things up and make it harder to prove anything about what happened that day. And it works. Anyway, moving on to the next section, people talk about, body cams helping with this. And I agree, body cams would help with this kind of stuff, but there have to be some changes from the kinds that have been proposed so far. Like most of the ones I see have seen people talk about so far actually have to have some degree of active input, like the cop turns it on before an encounter and oops, forgot. Not like the dash cams, which I gather are permanently on, but the body cams. And this is limitations of the hardware and such that they can't just be recording continuously, but that, come on, they can fix that. That's a technology issue. And the evidence getting lost. Oops, it accidentally got erased. Oops, we misplaced it. Oh, come on, really? You know, there should be mechanisms in place that these things are recording constantly and they are archived permanently and immediately. There's a flip side of this, of course. These things are intended to monitor the behavior of police officers, but in fact, they also monitor the behavior of absolutely anybody within sight of the police officers the entire time they're on. And so for those of us concerned about surveillance type issues, it really is a mixed bag here. Because you're essentially just adding to public surveillance in general. But I think it's worth it because we've got a history of abuse. And this is not to say... Yeah, just to be clear, most cops are great, upstanding people that do the right thing and are concerned about their community, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of bad cops out there. And I don't necessarily mean corrupt cops, although there are a lot of them too, but also just cops that get off on their authority and abuse it. Because they think, that's what they're supposed to do or that's what they want to do or whatever. And anyway, but I think there's also just the question of what are the rules for when officers of the law are allowed to use force? Right now, they are incredibly broad. It's basically you know, completely at the cop's discretion. All they have to say is they thought they were in danger. You know, I think it has to be a reasonable thought that they were in danger. But they don't even have to be right. They don't have to be right that they were in danger, or that somebody else was in danger. They just have to have, you know, some sort of reasonable story to give of why they think they were in danger. And as I said, they can use force after fleeing felons. There are all sorts of situations here. And I think it's incredibly overbroad. And even within those rules, there is no consistent enforcement when they're violated. Because of exactly what we're seeing here, the blue wall, as they say, it should be automatic that in any of these uses of force, there's an investigation that's an outside investigation, not from that police department, preferably not even from anybody local, that can act independently and outside of the police and the regular prosecution channels, because all of those have all kinds of incentives lined up to not go after the bad cop. And there are certainly cases where they have gone after bad cops, but the incentives are all lined up against that. And you see this sort of culture of covering up this shit. And as long as that's the culture, we have to be actively looking to combat it. And so there's that. And then I kept thinking when I thought about this, as people kept posting all kinds of stats on, you know, for instance, I think it was in Utah. There have been more civilians killed by police in Utah in whatever time period they were looking at than there were by gang members. That's a problem. And I'm wondering, you know, should it even be the norm that police officers carry firearms? You know, the standard example is, of course, England, and actually it's all of the UK except Ireland. Most police officers don't carry guns. Still, today, some do, and they're called in specially when it seems to be needed. But most don't. They have a variety of weapons, but they're intended as non-lethal weapons. Shorter range weapons, you know, yeah, the batons and nightsticks and probably tasers and things along those lines. And how much would it really hurt us if that was the case here? I wonder how many of, you know, the deaths that are caused by police officers in this country could have been avoided without a bad result. Not, you know, because of course the justification is the police officer carries it out of, you know, self-defense or whatever. And if they didn't carry them, then we'd have police officers being killed and beaten all over the place. And I don't know. I think that's an overblown concern. I think it's maybe you'd get some of that. But if you saved any number of lives, and I'm not just talking about innocent people, although of course I care about innocent people. We had this situation where police officer killed the 12-year-old boy who was had a BB gun that he'd removed the little orange thing that makes it look like a toy. And if the police officer had not been carrying a firearm, that kid would be alive today. You know, and are there scenarios where, you know, if the police officer wasn't carrying a firearm, they would have trouble? Probably. But you make sure that, you know, if you are in a situation that looks like it's going to require it, you get a call that there's an active shooter or whatever. Okay, you bring in the police with the handguns or rifles or whatever. Maybe you even let the police officers have their guns in their cars. But just don't carry them on them unless there's a specific reason to do so. There are all kinds of things that you could do to sort of help the de-escalation. And again, other countries have done this successfully. There's no reason the United States couldn't. And then, of course, there's the direct racial component on this. You know, there are people who, I've seen the arguments made that says, you know, there's a police officer, police violence issue. Let's address that. Let's not bring race into it, et cetera, et cetera. You have to. Because study after study after study, and all kinds of stats in all kinds of places, show there is huge disparity here in terms of how blacks and whites and other groups are treated in these types of situations. I mean, and this is purely anecdotal, but of, and I don't like anecdotal evidence, but just I've seen all kinds of tweets over the last couple months that this is going on, comparing incidents of cases where we had actual active shooters who were white, who actually posed a threat, and in some cases had already shot people, who were taken into custody alive. And meanwhile, case after case after case, where you have black men, usually young black men, who, as it turns out, were not actually a threat, or if they were a threat, it was a minor threat, who were shot and killed. And you see these type of reactions, you know, where there's clearly a dramatic difference in terms of how, on average, again, on average, this isn't every situation in every place, police, if they go into a situation and see a young black male, will react in a much more hostile and aggressive way than if they hit that same situation and you had a white male of the same age. And how do you battle that? I mean, some of it, like in Ferguson, you've got the bizarre situation where you've got this huge mismatch between the composition of the force and the composition of the community. I'm sure that contributes to it. You've got sort of ingrained prejudice that is all over the place. You know, people like to say, oh, well, we're well beyond that. No, I'm sorry, we're not. And a lot of it may be subconscious. A lot of it may be people who are like, I'm not racist at all. But if you do the psychological tests where you flash pictures in front of them quickly and ask for immediate reactions, guess what? There's a bias, and there's a significant bias. And how do you fight that? Part of it is going to be training. Part of it is acclimatizing people to, you know, to each other and encouraging more interaction, because you still have lots and lots of self-segregation as well on both sides. Even if there's no legal segregation, you know, most communities are fairly insular and only talk to themselves. There are, of course, pockets where that's not true, but it's very, very common throughout this country. And yeah, I don't have any magic solutions. And hey, as a white guy, I'm not like the most qualified in the world to talk about this stuff anyway. One of the things that I remember just, my wife is black. I'm white. We're a multiracial couple. I guess technically speaking, she's anyway, there's this mixed, everywhere, but, she identifies as black. And when we lived in Florida, I was completely oblivious. But later on, she told me one of the reasons she felt distinctly uncomfortable in Florida and felt so much better when we moved to Washington State is in Florida, when she and I went out together, she would always get looks. And people sort of being judgmental and looking at her and you know, what are you doing with him and things like that. I was completely oblivious, had not the slightest clue a damn thing was going on. But apparently this was a fairly common, near constant thing whenever we went out in public. And I was clueless. But she noticed every single day. And so there's definitely a perspective thing here. And I'm glad it's better here in Western Washington. I guess that's good. But I think there needs to be, especially for people like police officers, but it extends beyond that. It goes to teachers. It goes to people in any sort of governmental organization. It work basically any place that works with the public. I mean, storekeepers. You know, there's figuring out how to get past these inherent biases or built-in biases, overt and others, is going to be critical to our continued success. We can't have sort of this built-in thing where significant parts of the public look at each other with distrust every day. And it's unhealthy for huge parts of the country to grow up feeling like they can't trust the police, they can't go to the police for help, and the police are out to get them. It's unhealthy as a society. But at the same time, you can't necessarily blame them because there's all kinds of evidence that says they're absolutely right. They do get harassed more. They do get pulled over more. They do get shot more. How do you fix it? I have no freaking clue. I wish I knew. I wish I had a magic wand. I don't. I mentioned that podcast about sort of human behavior and being aware of things. And again, people being, you know, self-conscious about not being perceived as racist apparently doesn't help. It makes it worse. You know, you have to sort of be more willing. And part of what they said in this was, actually, the situations that are best are when people actually are more relaxed about it and are willing to go in and, you know, confront the issue and make a mistake if they do. Like, if there is a bias, they make a mistake and be willing to be corrected on it and talk about it and don't pretend it doesn't exist, basically. And people putting themselves outside of their comfort zone in interactions that, you know, they wouldn't maybe naturally have to get more exposure to use the word, a more diverse group of people. Anyway, it's a mess. I haven't even gotten to the stupid reaction to the thing. Okay, last bit, and then I want to wrap this up. Then we have the verdict come down, and we had a whole bunch of people organizing for peaceful protests. And then, unfortunately, completely predictable, we also had a bunch of people going in and burning things and looting and causing property damage and this and that and that, and making a mess of everything. And we had the police and authorities making it worse by doing this huge, massive show of force. And just as I was saying, maybe police shouldn't be carrying guns all the time, maybe only when they're really necessary, all of this super militarized, you know, riot squads and armored vehicles and heavy weapons and all this kind of stuff to, you know, monitor the protesters and keep them under control. Oh my God, really? Could you possibly make it any worse? You know, look, here's one thing. And I said this when we were talking about the Occupy movement a couple years ago. Protesting is about as fundamental an American value as you can possibly come up with. It's important. And the authorities should be doing everything in their power to enable nonviolent protest wherever possible. They shouldn't be about restricting it. They shouldn't be about setting up free speech zones. They shouldn't be about saying you can stand here and protest, but not there. You know, people were angry about what the grand jury decided, and with good reason. Even if you can justify what the grand jury decided, as I sort of did earlier, you can understand why people will be angry, or you should understand. And for God's sake, let them just don't put the police all out all over the place, at least not in their heavy riot gear and blah, 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 and pointing guns at everybody and tear gas. Let them take over the fucking streets. Let them take over the community. Let them, you know, okay, don't let them burn down buildings. Don't let them burn down cars, but let them march, let them protest, let them be in the street. Don't try to kettle them. Don't try to restrict them. Let them express their frustration. And yeah, okay, if they shut down some streets, so fucking be it. You know that every other country in the world, when we watch the protests in Ukraine, when we watch the protests in Egypt, a few years ago when we watched them in Iran, every time the government did anything to restrict those protesters, we were up in arms saying, yo, the protesters are in the right here. Yo, let them go. This is the will of the people. Blah, 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 blah. Well, apply that at home. You know, and yes, that perhaps includes some economic disruption. You know, you block the streets long enough, people can't do business. Fine. Okay, draw the line at property destruction and actual violence against human beings. Absolutely. Draw that line. I agree with that line completely. But as long as they're peaceful, even if they're blocking the fucking way to your businesses, let them do it. That is an important free speech right. And getting in its way, first of all, escalates the situation. You get these, you know, all these heavily armored troops with their guns in here. Of course, it's going to make the situation more tense. If you didn't have that at all, people would protest for a couple days and then go back to their lives, most likely. Or maybe not, and it would grow and it grow into popular movement and it'd be actually changed somewhere and blah, blah, blah. And maybe that's good. But if you come out with the viewpoint that the protesters are the enemy, you are escalating the situation, you are making it worse, and worse than that, I'd say, you're violating a fundamental American value that everybody has their right to express their opinion, and express their opinion in ways that, the whole point is, it gets in your face. You know, it's not this, they could write a letter to the editor of the paper or post something on their blog or whatever, but that doesn't have the same impact as seeing that there's X many tens of thousands of people who are willing to come out and camp on the street and block things and hold up their signs and get your attention. They should be able to do that. And, you know, trying to, you know, control that and force it into certain molds only, not okay. And completely aside from a moral issue too, it's counterproductive. It makes the situation worse. Okay, I'm done. I apologize for a long rambling show where I repeated myself many times and was very disorganized. Not only didn't I have somebody to bounce off of to sort of keep me in check, I also didn't start from any notes or outline or anything. I just rambled. And I know that sometimes sucks. But, you know, hey, it is what it is. Happy Thanksgiving again, everybody. I'm out. We love to hear from you. I'm Abelsmay at abelsmay.com on email. Or you can reach me at Abelsmay on Twitter. And Yvonne is, of course, at I am Bo. And he'll hopefully be back next week. And we'll talk again. So, tell your friends that they should listen to, and have a great week. Goodbye, everyone.